don't fear me, because I know what I want. Please deliver me, that's all part of your soul. It makes you freeze time, staring in at yourself. It's time to step outside onto the path you once made.
Through my iPad, because I haven't got my I haven't set up the Skype on my desktop, so I'm just doing it through my iPad. Hopefully it'll be okay. I've never had any problems up to now, so
seems to be working good.
Yeah, sounds clear. Yeah. Oh, cool. So you've done Adam.
Yeah, I did. I recorded with Adam.
Oh yeah, I see you've.
And then I went to record with DJ, but the file got lost somehow and didn't work, so I got to reschedule with him.
Oh, no. So did you do the whole show?
Yeah, we talked. We had, like, a good conversation for, like, an hour and a half, and then it just didn't record for some reason.
Oh, nightmare. Yeah. Nightmare.
So, to start things out, you want to introduce yourself?
Hey, well, my name is Nick Brokenshire. I'm from Aberdeen in Scotland, the northeast of Scotland, although I currently live in the northern part of England with my wife, because she's from here. I got into making comics about semi-professionally about 5 years ago with Adam and DJ when we first started developing the Amelia Cole series. Previous to that, I was a high school art teacher, and I'd never really made comics. I'd made lots of little strips and, you know, lots of illustrations. I did illustration at university, but I never really did anything with it, other than make posters for my band and stuff like that. When Adam and DJ contacted me, we started working on Amelia Cole, and initially that was just supposed to be a web thing that we were doing, and it kind of snowballed because Monkey Brain Comics showed interest in us, and so we became part of their crew, and then they passed us on to the IDW crew, and the next thing we knew, we were making comics for Monkey Brain and IDW. And then 5 years later, we had five trades of Amelia Cole, and now we're working on this Once and Future Queen for Dark Horse.
So this was, Amelia Cole was your first real, like, doing a comic?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. I essentially learned the rules as we went along. I'd done strips, and the way that Adam and DJ discovered me, so to speak, was that I'd done a short, let's see, about 15-page story that I'd put onto my old website. It's not up anymore, but and that was a thing called and Barnaby, and I'd seen that, but that those 15 pages had taken me like a year to do, because I didn't really know what I was doing, but I was just learning how to make, you know, comic book strips. So they saw that, and then we started on Amelia. But really, I learned cartooning from doing Amelia Cole.
What was the way to phrase it? What was the hardest lesson you learned when you first started doing Amelia Cole?
So many, because I gotta think about this. I think what for me one of the toughest things was coloring. It was all quite hard actually, but like coloring was tricky because it's quite a, certainly the way we did it, it was quite a time consuming thing. And in the early days, I had Reese Moreno doing flatting, so that helped a bit. But he had to leave after a bit, so I was doing all the colours pretty much from volume two onwards, I think. And that's just so time consuming that finding good ways to do it, to doing the colours was kind of always this uphill. Struggle for me. I don't know why. Other things for me that I found difficult were like you have to learn lots of lessons, obviously, when you're learning cartooning. But there are things like, you know, when and when not to use reference. And I discovered to my great chagrin that I often didn't use reference when really I should have. So like I'll look at artwork that I do that I've done in the past and really cringe because I know that I could have done it better had I just used reference, you know. And the thing is that like once you do use reference a few times, then that teaches you how to do that particular thing, and then you don't have to use reference anymore.
Yeah.
So you've basically learned, you know, you've learned a thing. And then that becomes part of your arsenal. But sometimes, for one reason or another, as a cartoonist, you end up kind of avoiding the reference thing, and you're just making life hard for yourself. So that was a thing. I don't know if that made any sense, but
yeah, I remember I mentioned to Adam one of my favorite things about reading the first issue of Once and Future Queen was actually the coloring work. I thought it was amazing in it.
Yeah. The color, well, I mean, the whole visual, you know, language of Once and Future Queen was, I figured it out very, very specifically before we even started. Because, like, with Amelia, there was no real figuring out of anything. It was all flying by the seat of our pants. So I made a very conscious effort to have, including, well, colors, you know, locked down tight. So I have a very specific process and a very specific approach to how I do the colors, rather than just making it up, which is how I used to do it.
Do you have like I see like different sorts of scenes have different colors. Do you have it like in your head that, oh, this is this type of scene, so I'm going to use this type of coloring theme?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Each color will have each scene will have a color that hopefully reflects the, you know, the flavor of that scene. Not necessarily in obvious ways. For example, in the first issue, there's like a big fight scene at the end, and the real kind of basic background color is pink, you know, and it's not because necessarily we think of pink as a you know, an aggressive color, but it's just for some reason when I was out, it just sat well, so I stuck with pink. So I tend to find the color for the scene, but it has to somehow, you know, reflect the vibe of the scene.
I noticed that about that scene, like where the background's a pinkish color, and then when it settles there for a bit, and then it goes back to the almost orange color, and I thought that was very well, like it shifted in a very powerful way, I thought.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it was figuring out, but yeah, I think it seems to be a reasonably effective thing. I've seen things like let's see, it's a totally different book, but in James Robinson's Air Boy, mm-hmm. they did a similar thing where each scene had very specific color things, and as a scene evolved, you know, and as it changed gear, it would shift in color. So that had a bit of an influence on me, because I've always liked that sort of thing. Whereas, like, with referring back to Amelia, we did that whole thing to be accessible and kind of old school kids comic type thing. You know, everything was a very specific color, like the houses would be gray and the sky would be blue and that sort of thing. Whereas I kind of came to the conclusion that that doesn't need to be part of the equation. We don't have to have rules like that. So, yeah.
Have you colored all your work that you worked on so far?
Yeah, everything, yeah.
So go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that I'd love to be able to work with a colorist, but we've never really been able to afford it.
Does that influence like your artwork when you go like when you're doing the pencils and stuff? Do you think like about colors in certain scenes and change your mind about how you're going to do it?
It used to. That was part of the whole big learning curve that when I was doing everything for Amelia, I would often like cut quite a lot of corners and think to myself, well, because in the colors I'll fill this bit in, you know what I mean? And what I discovered was that sort of thinking led to quite patchy artwork. So you'll find, like, you know, in those five volumes of Amelia, there are areas where sometimes it's very densely full of stuff, and then sometimes it goes quite sparse. And those moments were when I was foolishly trying to, while I was at the penciling stage, think ahead to how the coloring would affect it. So now what I do is when I'm at the, you know, laying out and penciling and inking stage, I view the page as a complete thing. So I don't think about the colors. I make the colors fit the page as opposed to the other way around, you know?
Yeah. Have you did any coloring outside your own work?
You like for other people?
Yeah.
Let me think. No. No, I don't think I have.
I don't think I've...
It's funny you should mention...
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's funny you should mention that because I've had such a, you know, a positive experience colouring this book, I did wonder to myself, I was like, I wonder if I could do it for someone else. You know, I don't know, because it's certainly not a priority because I have plenty of things to do of my own, but it's interesting you ask that.
I haven't really heard too many conversations with colorists because I don't know, like, you never hear like that many interviews with them. So I find it interesting to know how long does it take to color a page?
Sorry, I'm drinking beer while we're chatting, so
it's all right.
You don't mind. Obviously, it depends on how much is going on in that page, but I think for me it takes like 2 or 3 hours to do a page. Sometimes less. And that's using this very specific kind of approach that I have now, which is it's cut down quite a lot on. It's cut the work down a little bit because I've worked it all out, how I approach it. But when I was trying to do it traditionally, where you have, you know, you have to flat every element in each panel, that would take ages. It would sometimes take 3, 4, 5 hours to do, depending on if it was a particularly complex page. And I think mainly that's because I wasn't very experienced. I'm sure that I'm sure that, you know, Jordi Belair or whatever would make quick work of a page, but for me it took a long time. Now I think I've got it down to about 1 or 2 hours per page. Yeah.
So do you finish like a basically a whole issue before you go and then color it, or do you do it page by page?
No, I draw the whole thing first. So the whole thing is penciled and inked before I even start to think about color.
So it's the final stage in the artwork?
For me, yes. Yeah. I mean, yeah, pretty much. Then obviously, well, for me, like the lettering is very, very much part of the artwork. Like if I had the time and the skill, I would like to do, you know, the balloons and the lettering within within the artwork myself, but time doesn't allow that to happen. So I view, you know, the lettering that Frank does as very much part of the artwork. And we work very closely together to develop the style that he uses, because I think it's part of the whole visual language, you know?
Yeah, and plus, like, history of comics has proven that one member of a team can actually make great art before it, and the steps look bad. I mean, the famous cases is some of Jack Kirby's artwork has been famous for people showing it in pencils of being great, and then certain inkers come along and making it look bad.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think letterers, I know for a while people like John Workman and stuff were hugely, you know, lauded, but I still get the sense that, you know, letterers need to get the good ones need to get more recognition, because they really, they're responding to the art, you know, they're responding to the art and the script. So they have to have a certain sensitivity, you know, artistic sensitivity. But letterers. I wish more did them by hand. I know it's kind of hard to do in the normal pace of comics these days, but I love hand-lettered comics, you know?
Speaking of which, is all your coloring done digitally?
Well, it's a bit of a combination, actually. I prepared what you call grounds, or basically backgrounds. I created a bunch of backgrounds using watercolors and acrylic paints and inks, and they're basically text, like washes of textural color. Get a page and do these washes of color shapes, just colors bleeding into it, or different tones of the same color. So like, say, yellows, like darker yellows and much yellows all bleeding in each other on a page. And I use that as, I use a bank of these things, and I use them as the background for the panels. So I'll see a panel and I think, oh, that one needs this particular texture. So I'll drop that in behind the inks. And then I'll go on, and then I'll sort of go in with a digital watercolor brush and basically paint onto another layer. So I use those hand painted backgrounds as if they were a canvas, you know, and then you know, start painting in there with a digital watercolor brush on the computer. So it's a combination of things, really.
That's pretty interesting. I hadn't heard of somebody doing it that quite way. It's usually like one or the other.
Yeah. It's both.
But that probably is why some of the scenes, I think, have a lot of depth to them, it looks like, looking at it.
Yeah. Well, that's good to hear. I'm glad that you say that, because, you know, that was definitely one of the challenges for me was to try and do something with colors that, you know, that gave things depth.
So with the characters like Ronnie, did y'all do firm character designs like a lot before you started working on the book? And if you did you have a lot of say in the look of the character?
Yes, yeah, I did. The boys, Adam and DJ, came to me with the concepts. The basically what they say to me is, you know, they concept that it might be. So they said to me, you know, they wanted her to be kind of a punk girl. But they gave no other specifics, and obviously that she was half Indian, so that's all I had to go with. So, you know, she was a punk half Indian girl, and so from that point onwards, and also that she was, you know, like her personality was they sort of detailed that a little bit to me. You know, the kind of person that she was a little bit more, but you know. Introverted person, a little bit more serious than, say, Amelia Cole. So that using that and other little bits of information with me, I just filled lots of sketchbook pages with designs, and then I would throw them over to them, and we'd whittle things down. Like, one of the first things that I came up with was her hair, and the idea about her hair was that it kind of reflected the spiky crown thing on the queen chess piece, but yeah, and then I would just throw ideas at them, and then we come up with a design. But it kind of all falls down to me, really.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of people know how much work goes in design wise to a comic. But there's probably like days and hours and months that go into that before you even start working on the story, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, a lot of time. In fact, I think we even started it while we were wrapping Amelia Cole up. So we kind of had an idea. I can't remember actually, Brian. It might have been before we ended it, but I know that I had 2 months after we ended Amelia and before we started, before I had to start drawing pages for Once a Future Queen. I had 2 months, and I was doing another job, but I spent those 2 months basically just designing everything and everyone, and you know, coming up with the approach for the colors and everything. So it took, and it's not just, you know, 2 months of 1 or 2 hours a day. It's 2 months of like 10 hours a day sitting here coming up with stuff.
So did y'all, with this issue, and I think Adam told me it was like 5 issues, isn't the series so far? The plan is?
Yes.
So do you get like all the artwork done before the book comes out, or are you still working on later issues?
I'm currently in the middle of inking issue 4. Mm-hmm. So basically, I get given essentially 2 months to do each issue, and I started in August, so a good run up, because, you know, yeah. So we had a good run up. So I had issue I can before this week when the first issue was released. So for the remaining 3 months or so, I'll be working on 4 and 5, as you know, as the issues come out.
Now, do you already have all the scripts for the whole series?
Oh yeah, yeah. Adam and DJ work quite far ahead, so I've got all the scripts. I had pretty much all the scripts by the time, let's see, but probably about Christmas, all 5 scripts. But they you know, they really work hard, those two, you know, to get the stuff out.
Is that very beneficial to have all the future scripts for, like, seeing how things are moving towards the future?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a bit, again, it's kind of a bit of a balance, because I try not to know too much about stuff. and so that I can respond to certain things on the spot, in order to keep a little bit of a little bit of spontaneity in what I do. But at the same time, you know, there are really important things that I need to know up front before, I might end up designing something that completely goes against a scene that happens later on. So I need to know as much as I can, really, whilst in time trying to keep things fresh. I don't know if that makes sense, but yeah it's good to be forewarned.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. Some of my prose books right now, I'm having them narrated for audio, and I asked if the narrator wanted all the books that we have done so far, and she said she really didn't, unless it's something important for her to go, because she wanted to work with what she had. So I understand that a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. It's also a way of keeping it fresh, you know? Like, you don't be bored with the story before you even start, you know?
Yeah, it's easy enough to do with, like, writing sometimes. Like, if you already have everything mapped out in your head, sometimes it's like, well, I know how everything's going.
Right. So you write books, do you?
Yeah, I write. I have like a middle grade series right now. I'm doing like one book a year for a middle grade book series, and we're also going back and adapting them chapter by chapter, and releasing them in audio that way.
Oh, fun! That's great.
Which is a whole new experience hearing somebody speak your words.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah, I can well imagine.
So, yeah. So with this, from Amelia Coe to this book, what is, like, in your way, the thing you're loving the most that wasn't in Amelia Coe but is in this book? Like, that makes it different?
Well, to be honest, for me, the biggest thing is to be able to put into effect a lot of the lessons that I learned because of Amelia Coe. Amelia, that was a roller coaster, basically, that there was no stopping it. It was this thing that just took off, and we had to see it through to the end, and it was very good, and I love the characters and I love the story. But for me, it felt a little bit like I was holding on, you know, like a white knuckle ride a little bit. So a lot of the time I was running along, trying to keep up, learning lots of lessons, not always lessons that I could put into action, simply because of time and schedules and all that sort of thing. So now with this, it just feels like everything that I've learned, I've been able to take a step back, take a breath, and put it into this book. So to me, it feels more rounded out. It feels visually more coherent. And just for me, just more together. You know, I think it speaks more clearly. So as the artist, I get more pleasure from that. And that's not to say I get pleasure out of Amelia. I did, but it was a little bit frantic, like I said. Where this one, we had a bit of a run up before the release this week, so again, I didn't feel too rushed, even though I am working, you know, right up to deadlines. But it just didn't feel as pressured, and I feel that you know reflects in the art. I think, I hope so, anyway.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, too. Also, like, when you're working on a series, it tends to develop its own personality, and things you've learned during that series you may not be able to apply because it has that certain personality, so your next project you can apply these things to.
Exactly. That's exactly that. Very good, yeah. That's very much the point, because, like, there was a very specific language that we came up with for Amelia, and some of it was stuff that I wasn't really all together clued up on, you know. So, like, I feel that, you know, some of the things that I was doing, I didn't really know what I was doing, basically. And it all kind of became the visual language of that book. So I couldn't stop doing it, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
That's a really good good way of putting it.
Were you into Arthurian legends and myths before this book?
Oh yeah, yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think it's kind of, Arthurian stuff is sort of part of our culture in Britain anyway. It's kind of part of the general mythology of this country. You know, you can't really get away from it. So I grew up reading. I mean, as soon as you start reading fantasy books and even like Lord of the Rings, you start discovering things like, you know, Beowulf and the Arthurian legends and all that sort of thing. And it just seems to be part of the national makeup here. So like I grew up reading Le Morte d'Arthur and stuff. Well, I tried to read it when I was a kid and all that sort of stuff. And then, of course, things like Excalibur, the John Boorman movie. It was big when I was a kid. Love that stuff.
Yeah, I was a big fan of that and studied quite a bit when I was in college, too, which I really enjoyed. Even before I got into comics, I was into Arthur and stuff.
Oh, it's superb, yeah. And there's so many, you know, kind of versions of it and, you know, so many interpretations of it it's really to delve into.
Yeah, if you study it, like, people even, like, I remember a teacher saying, like, oh, this bit of Arthurian legend might actually be from Scotland, and this little bit of Arthurian legend might be from this country and stuff, and it's just gotten melded together through the storytelling over the centuries.
Well, that's what I find quite interesting is that, because I'm from Scotland, and I have a lot of ancestors from Cornwall. Like the traditionally, you know, the whole Arthurian thing is sort of set often in Cornwall. But then, you know, there's talk of it being set in Wales, and talk of it being set in here and there, and then there's also, you know, like the connection to Celtic myths of Ireland and Wales and Scotland. So it's kind of all, like you say, it's all in there in the mix. And you can't, and as soon as you start to delve in a little bit, you start to realize that it's all in some way kind of interconnected in various ways.
Yeah, it's interesting when you see when the stuff entered a legend, even like stuff like the Green Knight. Like there's little mm-hmm. stories, if you track back, to where they were original, and then they started entering, like, the Arthurian legends and weaving inside of that at times and stuff. So, like, I've always found it really fascinating, even with a study of storytelling, the beginning with, like, Arthurian legends
It also crosses over into music, because, like, our folk traditions here, I'm a big fan of the folk traditions of the British Isles, and weirdly, that's because I used to really like bands like Jethro Tull and stuff like that, and through them, I went into bands like Pentangle and Fairport Convention and stuff like that, and they're often drawing from, you know, mythology, folklore, and legends that also tie into Arthurian stuff, and yeah, it's all part of my personal makeup. So when the boys said, you know, that they wanted to do something connected to Arthurian and stuff, I was like, yep, I'm in.
Some of my favorite Arthurian stuff is like the Excalibur movie, which I loved when I was younger, and Camelot 3000, the comic series, which I love. And let's see, The Sword and the Stone, the Disney movie. What would you say is your favorite?
It's for me, I think it's definitely like Excalibur, the movie. I love that thing. I watched it over and over. I think for me, like that one, it sums up like the weird grimy magic, you know, that the visuals of that movie kind of have a strange kind of muddy magic quality to it, which I really like. There was another series, actually. I'm trying to remember what the name of it is, and it was a book written by a woman. I can't remember now, but I remember that had a bit of an effect on me when I was a teenager, and that was a different take. It might have even been kind of focusing more on Guinevere.
Mists of Avalon?
It could well be.
Yeah.
I read a bunch of stuff, you know, at the time. I don't think it was that. I can't remember, mate. I don't know.
Well, there's a lot of Arthurian stories out there.
Yeah. Actually, I went through a real kind of poetry phase in my late teens, and I used to read a lot of Tennyson. Well, I used to try, there was one story like The Lady of Shalott, and I used to be really intrigued by that, and you know, the imagery and that. And he did other stuff about Camelot, because he was the poet laureate, so he would tackle all the traditional English and British mythology in his poetry. And I used to spend hours poring over that stuff and not fully being able to grasp it, but just picking out phrases and really liking it, you know.
Well, like you said, like the British way of life is basically intertwined with those stories. But like, even if you look at where Princess Diana was buried, that very ties into like the Lady of the Lake in a way. If you look into where it is, like, it's very interesting.
Where is she buried? Huh? Is it in Northampton?
Yeah, they buried her. Like, I don't know exact location, but it's on kind of like an island location, and they're like saying that is supposed to be the lake where the Lady of the Lake supposed to have given up Excalibur, supposedly.
Right, hang on, I'm just looking it up now. Yeah, you're right. The Round Oval Lake. Hang on. Oh, I'm not going to read this at the moment we're talking. I'm going to have to look that up. I just read Alan Moore's Jerusalem. I don't know if you've tackled that.
No, I haven't read it yet.
Oh, man. That is a book. That is an incredible book. I didn't know if he could surprise me even more than he already has, but he really did with that book. And he goes on there about even that ties into certain Arthurian things, but he basically contends that Northampton, which is like this really gritty middle of England, is somehow essentially like this kind of vortex or like a central pivotal point to all history, you know, because all history in some way, all important histories have passed through this town, you know? which is where Alan Moore is from. And it's quite a compelling book and quite a compelling explanation as to why he thinks that. You should read it. It's great. It's like a billion pages long, though.
Yeah, I'd like to check that out. I've heard like people say it was an interesting book, but I'll have to check it out.
Like, yeah, it's good.
But like with, I talked to DJ a little bit about it in the podcast that got lost. But I talked to him a little bit about how even like Doctor Who, the sci-fi series, had a tie into King Arthur stories. I don't know if you've seen old classic Doctor Who much.
Well, I did, but I mean, I don't remember much of it. I watched it as a kid, you know. I grew up. I was during Tom Baker, you know. So,
the seventh Doctor story, which was Sylvester McCoy, there's a story called Battlefield. And it explores the fact that in an alternate reality, the Doctor was actually Merlin.
That rings a bell.
Yeah, it's a really interesting take, and they explored it some in the comics, that fact that he was actually Merlin and went to his other place. And like, it's an interesting story if you can watch old low budget stuff, check it out. It's called Battlefield. It has a really interesting take, I think, on King Arthur and stuff.
I will do. I'll watch that. That's fun.
And the comics that explore that was some of the comics that Dave Gibbons did for Doctor Who, which he's one of my favorite artists.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He's amazing.
With Once and Future Queen, like I said, we were talking about designs earlier, and I spoke to Adam about this. One of my favorite designs in that first issue is Merlin. Was that your original take on it from the beginning, or did you go through different designs with the character?
I had a couple of versions of it, but they all pretty much look the same. They said, you know, for various reasons, which you may or may not discover as the story develops, he's going to be wearing a spacesuit. So I came up with like a couple of designs, but it was always, you know, the big dome helmet and stuff like that. I wonder whether they wanted more of a B movie like sci-fi spacesuit. It occurred to me after I'd done it, I wonder if they wanted more of a, you know, like a Fear Agent style spacesuit. For me, this one is kind of like a cross between a normal spacesuit and a kind of, you know, your traditional B movie spacesuit. But the color thing, I don't know if they specified that he had to glow green or anything. But like they in the script, they said that when he appeared, you know, that there was a green glow. So in the comic, you know, when they're in the cave, it's very green. And for me, I just decided that from that point onwards, he would always glow green, because that would tie in with the reason why he's in a spacesuit in the first place. So does that answer your question? I don't know. I got a bit lost there.
Yeah, that's fine. I'm right now looking at the issue. And that scene, and I think one of the interesting things about that scene is what you don't color in it. Like, when you choose not to do all the backgrounds and how the greens don't have other colors with it, and it's just green and white. I think that works very well.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. I'm glad you think so, because a lot of this book is about what not to color, you know, for me. As soon as I start finding myself, you know, launching into adding a color, I have to just say, hang on, you know, do you need it? Or does the art tell you what you need to know? You know what I mean? Without having to add lots of colors. So, yeah.
That must be a hard choice for somebody to make, because your instinct would be automatically, like, I have to have color to stuff automatically.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is very counter to your, like you say, to your instinct. I'm just calling up on my Comixology, because I've not properly looked at it on the Comixology yet. I haven't actually looked at it on the comic. You know how you can look at your iPad, but I've not looked at the Comixology thing on my computer. That's quite nice. The greens are, I like that bit.
Anyway, another thing I thought was interesting was your choice of panel layout. Like how in the big fight scene, it's not really a standard panel layout. And I like that. I think not enough people do that. Like they choose to, are brave enough to jump from one panel layout to the other.
Right. The idea with the panel layout, actually, if I'm perfectly honest, I think I discovered one slight issue which maybe I should have picked up on, and that is that there are two pages where the backgrounds where it's the full on fighting bit, and the backgrounds are pink, and I kind of failed to notice that it may not seem 100% clear whether it's a double page spread or whether it's two pages next to each other. I mean, I think that's because of the, you know, because of the pink backgrounds. But like you said, the idea of the funny panel layout is, if you read like a lot of manga, which I have done, they will do a lot of, you know, twisting of panels in order just to create a sense of like imbalance. If there's a fight or something, you know, they'll shift the angle of the panels in order to just to screw with the balance, you know.
Yeah, I think it works for that scene because it's a very chaotic, close quarters, one room fight scene with several people, and it actually adds to the chaos.
Well, that's good. Yeah, that's good. I'm glad you say that because I do agree. I agree with you. Like when they first appear, it's a very colorful page, and then as soon as they start fighting, it kind of just settles into this, like you said, chaos. So yeah, that was fun. It was quite hard actually, because I've not done full, you know, like body combat artwork for a long time. I'd done some in like the middle of the Amelia Cole story, but a lot of it was just people shooting magic bolts at each other as opposed to literally punching and cutting each other. I found it quite difficult, but I enjoyed it.
Do you do any kind of research when you do battle scenes or anything, or is it mainly like you're just trying to figure out what they want, or do they, better way of stating it is like, do you decide how the choreography of a battle works, or is it described in a script?
It's kind of a bit of both. Like they Adam and DJ will say, you know, Rani, you know, attacks. Like each of the Fae characters, they've all got names. So they'll say, you know, so and Rani beats so and so, or hits him with her sword, but they won't say how. What I do is like I'll take, you know, the basic skeleton of what they're saying, and I literally photograph myself. doing various movements from both sides of the fight. So like there's the, on the panel of when Gwen punches one of the Fae and says, "Take that, ugly." That's, you know, that's lifted straight from like a scene that I photographed myself of myself doing those poses. I don't know if that explains it, but yeah, a bit of both. They explain what they want, and then I figure out how to do it through me jumping around in my studio.
Well, yeah, that goes back to the thing like with comic book artists being described as directors and, you know, choreographers and everything else. My background in writing originally was film script, so I've been on a few film sets when I used to do like festival work and stuff like that, trying to get in the business. And and if you've studied film, you'll know that most of the time the directors don't do anything with fight scenes. They have second unit fight choreographer, second unit directors do that. But with you, you have to choreograph those fight scenes yourself.
Yeah, it's true. And you do as well, like literally. It used to make it very difficult, but now, well, literally for everything that I do in this book, I choreograph everything, even just people walking down the street, just so that I don't leave anything to guesswork, you know?
Yeah. Like you talked about reference work earlier. I know there's like kind of a kickback against some artists doing that, but I've never seen why it's such a bad thing if you use reference work to learn. It's like when you're early as a writer, you tend to use other people's style a little bit until you learn how to do it, and I consider it about the same thing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think I think the issue can be like if you rely too heavily on reference, like if you use like that program Poser where you can literally take a figure and pose it, and then you know you can literally just trace over a posed figure, then that kind of may take some of the life out of your drawing. I don't know, but you know, like I take my cues from illustrators, and when you look at like the classic illustrators and classic artists, and in fact all great artists used reference, especially if you're trying to create some of, if you're not bothered about realism, then don't use it. But if you want to try and infuse your cartooning with a sense of realism because you want to try and, I've seen, in a way, relate to, so that we understand the danger or whatever, then you have to do it in such a way that you recognize the stuff that you're looking at. And the best way to do that is to refer to the real thing. And anyone who wants to sidestep that will find, like I did, that they're making it more difficult for themselves. So like I said earlier, the more I draw Rani waving her sword about, the easier it'll become, and the less I will need that reference because I'll get used to it, and the stronger my cartooning will be. If you look at, you know, great cartoonists like Alex Toth, you know, he would use you know, reference photography of, you know, Errol Flynn in order to do his Zorro stuff, and no one contests that, you know. Well, so yeah. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, even going back to stuff like the Mona Lisa, the reason why there's always been debate over the decades about who it is because they know somebody was referenced, because that's what they did. Whether it was him as a painter turning himself into a female character or somebody he knew, they knew somebody was referenced because that's what you did.
You have to, you know? I mean, there are times when you don't have to, but you have to learn. You have to learn by, you know, one of the things that hopefully, you know, many artists do, and I do this, is, you know, go to life drawing classes, and that's just basically using real people as reference, as opposed to, you know, photographs or whatever, and that's just you just have to learn that stuff, and that's what reference is all about. It's not about, it can be about cheating if you're using it purely, you know, as a way to trick other people. But in my case, and hopefully in the case of other people, it's because you want to, you know, convey the information as well as you possibly can. And until such a time that I become Kim Jong-yi, I don't know if you know that guy, the Korean illustrator who can just like whip stuff out of thin air with incredible accuracy. Until I become that dude, I'm going to need reference.
Yeah. No, I haven't heard of him, but like you were talking about manga earlier, a lot of people think manga's done under one artist, and it's like, nope.
No.
You got background artists, you got the artists that learned to draw like the original artists and everything else.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, a lot of people, generally people who don't know kind of how tough it is to make a comic, they tend to be the ones that poo-poo the reference thing. But, you know, the people, if you talk to Neil Adams about reference, he'll tell you, do it, you know? And if you're lucky enough to develop a style or develop an approach that doesn't need reference, then that's fantastic. But for those of us lesser mortals, you know, we need reference.
Yeah, even like with writers, like if I'm trying to figure out how to do something, I'll go look at a book and I'm like, how did they do this? And there's nothing wrong with that. You're learning how to do something.
Of course, yeah.
Oh, so like to finish off this, I usually ask 5 questions, and there are 5 questions to never ask an artist.
Oh, blimey, okay.
So they're usually 5 questions that kind of anger a lot of artists and stuff. The first one is kind of easy, but it irritates some people because you get it asked constantly and there's no real answer, and it's, where do you get your ideas?
Okay. Adam and DJ, I get them from them. Blimey, where do I get my ideas? I'm constantly... I expect this might be the case for a lot of artists. I'm just trying to be as good as the artists that captured my my imagination when I was a kid. It's the stuff that impresses you when you're a kid. That's the stuff that stays with you, as far as I'm concerned. And so, like, for me, you know, Mobius and Drie and Sienkiewicz and, you know, Jaime Hernandez. For me, like, I'm just trying to basically do something that reflects those guys in what I do. And I know I'm nowhere near the mark, but that's kind of where I get my inspiration. So how's that? How does that fit the bill?
Yeah, and a lot of people think, like, influences mean you're going to write like them or do art like them. Like, my favorite writer is Douglas Adams. And even though there's tweaks in my writing that tends to be a little bit like his, I don't write anything like him. But that doesn't mean it's not an inspiration for how I do stuff.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, that's exactly right. So you don't want to copy them, obviously, but you just want to feel like you may be approaching them in some way. Certainly, that's what it's like for me. So, where do I get my ideas? Just from everywhere, you know.
That's the answer, though, with everybody. It's like they're everywhere. What?
yeah. Like, often it'll be it can be something as simple as you get a new pen. Like, I'll get a new set of like drawing nibs, you know, like when I first discovered these Japanese nibs called G nibs, like for dip pens, it infused me with such a sort of renewed desire to draw that it changed everything, you know. And it can be something as simple as that. And more than anything, for me, I think the thing that gets me to draw more is the idea of trying to capture people in some way. So, like, if you look at my sketchbooks, it's basically just people, just drawing people in as many different ways as I can, because that's what we all relate to at the end of the day. You know, what people are like, what they do, how they speak, how they move. That's what connects with us the most. So that's what I tend to draw the most.
Next question would be, like, how's this hobby going? I know a lot of writers, I mean, a lot of artists get that hobby thing thrown at them.
Yeah. Well, how's it going? Well, it's just constant discovery. So as far as when it was completely a hobby, it was easygoing and lots of fun. Now it is lots of fun, but there's kind of a bit of a pressure on it now, because I have to do it for other people and in order to, you know, meet deadlines and things. So it's kind of stopped being a hobby, but I still, you know, have a lot of fun doing it. Yeah. That's it.
The next question is, like, when people want you to, and I think this goes a little bit more with writers online, but when people want you to do stuff for free or just for exposure, and they kind of feel irritated that you should do it if you say no.
Yeah. That's a funny one, because, like, most people just don't understand the amount of work that it takes to create artwork. And so they think that drawing is this cute thing that you do like in 5 minutes, you know? So like when people say, well, you know, can you do, like, they'll ask me to do a drawing for them, and I'll say to them, well, I can't because I'm really busy, you know, and they'll say, well, can you do it at the, you know, when you're done with that? And it's weird because it's like saying to someone, it's like saying to a plumber after he's been working hard at being a plumber all day, can you come and do more plumbing? You know what I mean? It's not really their fault. It's not people's fault for not understanding that it is actually really intensive work. They think that because you're sitting basically poring over a table that it's not hard work. It is hard work. And there's no reason for them to know that because they've not encountered it. So sometimes you have to explain, you know, it's just not that straightforward. And generally, they kind of get it, but I'm pretty sure that most people just think I sit here playing video games and twiddling my thumbs and then drawing for 5 minutes.
But, yeah, it's like also the fact that all artists are different. Like I have a friend, I've been working on a graphic novel with him for 10 years, and everybody's like, why isn't it done yet? And it's like, well, it's not his regular job, plus the fact that he doesn't do artwork really fast. Like, he's really good, but he doesn't do it fast at all. Like, he could never do a monthly comic at all.
Right.
But like, people don't understand that, and they think, like, oh, there's something wrong if it's taking him that long. And it's like, no, it's like a 100-and-some page book, and it's going to be, like, it's just taking him a while because that's what it takes to do it.
Yeah. You might want to hurry him up a bit, though. 10 years is kind of pushing it.
Well, I don't really fuss about it because it's just something that we've been working on, and it's not really like a deadline or anything, you know what I mean? It's been something like in between his other projects he's been working on and stuff like that, but like, I think a lot of people don't understand that artists can't do, and also like some artists can do like a full book in a month, but that doesn't mean every artist can do it.
No. Like I have concentration issues, and I always have done from a young age. And like the only way that I can do, you know, a book the way I do is like I have to sort of I have to do other things. I have to pace around the room and get up every 10 minutes, and otherwise I just wouldn't get it done. Like I know some artists can just lock themselves down to a table and knock out 10, you know, 8 hours straight drawing. I can't do that. I have to do, I can do about an hour straight, and then I have to go do something and then come back and carry on, you know? So if you take that into consideration, you know, like when I get up in the morning, you know, I'll start at 8 or whatever, but I don't finish my day's work generally until about 9, 10 at night, because I have to split it. You know, I have to do, you know, big stretches of drawing and then go do something else and then eat and then more big stretches of drawing. It's just not straightforward. Whereas most people are used to the concept of just getting up, going to work, plodding on with their job and then going home. It's just not that easy with art.
And it's like artists are like writers can do writing all the time, even in their heads. Like artists, you got to eventually like sit down and have time to do it. So like y'all are even like more, it takes up more time, I think, with artists, because even though you need time to get up and move around and stuff, there's like a lot of time where you have to actually sit down and do it.
Oh yeah, you gotta just lock yourself down. Yeah, that's hard, you know. It's hard. Like I was a hyperactive child, you know, so like, and I think I'm a hyperactive old guy. I find it really hard, but you know, there are things that help, like, you know, heroin and drugs. Only kidding.
Well, it's like when people have like made the joke about like, oh, you can write good or you can do art good on drugs or alcohol, and it's like, no.
No.
Like, I don't like write. You know what you do? You think you're writing good when you're drunk or something like that, and then you like wake up in the morning and it's like, this is crap.
Yeah. We've all done it.
The next question it was actually suggested to friends of mine that go to conventions and table, and they say they have a lot of people come up to them and say, like, did you actually do this?
Yeah. You did this? Yeah. Well, all of it. Yes. Yeah, all of it. I listen, you get that every day. You get it every day. Even today, because I did a signing. I did a signing today in Manchester, in a city nearby. And people come into the comic shop and they're surrounded by comics. And they're surrounded by comics that they buy, you know, and books that they read. And then they'll pick up your book and they'll say, did you do this? And yeah, I did it. All of it? Yeah. You know, like all the other books were done by someone, you know, like I happened to do this one. It's weird. And again, I think it's just down to this weird thing where people, I think there's a bit of magic in art, you know, whether it be writing or music or, you know, comics or whatever. And we're lucky because we can tap into that magic. But a lot of people just they don't have a way in, you know, and their way in is to consume the art that we create. And so for them, it's just like it just must seem like a weird magical thing that happens out of thin air, you know.
Yeah,
that's the only thing I can think of. But
it's like when you try to explain that it's work, it's a job. Like, people don't get that. Like, you got to put in the work. Like, it's a lot of work.
It is. I try not to be judgmental of people like that because, you know, I wonder whether perhaps in the past I might have been like that. I don't think so, but maybe I was. I don't know.
I mean, it's like I was talking about, like, before I learned about the film industry, I didn't understand the fact that, like, the directors weren't there all the time and they had second unit directors that direct different stuff and, like, all the people that work on stuff. So, like, I do think, like, sometimes people don't understand, but that doesn't mean it doesn't irritate you when somebody's almost questioning what you do.
Yeah. Especially, like, it's not often grown-ups, but kids will often come up to you at a convention and go, you didn't do that. In fact, when I was still teaching, when I was doing, once I was doing comics, and I was still, you know, like, sometimes showing the kids some of the artwork that I did, and they'd be going, you didn't do that. And I'd be like, yeah, of course I did it. I'm holding it in my hands, you know, this is a thing I did. And they just can't believe it, you know.
It's like when I was at the American Library Association ALA convention in Orlando, which I live in Florida, but they were having it in Orlando, so I was tabling with a friend who's an artist, and we had several kids come up to him and be like, "You didn't do that artwork."
Yeah. So weird. Very strange. So whereabouts are you in Florida?
I live in Melbourne, Florida, which is not far from Orlando and, like, Disney and Universal Studios and stuff.
Yeah. Interesting. We were nearly going to come out this year because I play in a band called Blues Harvest, which is basically like a sort of geek band. And we play sort of Star Wars-based music and like 80s movie music and stuff. And we did the Star Wars celebration this year in London, and we were this close to coming out to Orlando to play at this year's celebration in Orlando. Is it Orlando or Anaheim? I think it's Orlando.
Yeah, it's Orlando. It's really, yeah. Well, they have one at both places.
Right.
But, like, yeah, I've been to this Star Wars celebration in Orlando. It's really cool, I think.
Yeah. But we're not going to this year. Anyway.
So I'll end this with, like, you, if you want to tell people where they can find you online.
Sure. My current favorite online pursuit, I'm kind of new to it, even though it's been around for ages, is Instagram. I was kind of silly because beating my head against the wall on Twitter and wondering why people didn't talk back to me. And then someone said to me, "What, you do pictures? Why don't you put pictures up?" And I was like, "Oh yeah, duh." So you can find me on Instagram. It's just Nick Brokenshire, NickBrokenshire. Also Nick Brokenshire on Twitter. Nick Brokenshire Comics and Illustration on Facebook. And I do have a Tumblr, just Nick Brokenshire, but I just have that connected to my Instagram. So whatever I put on Instagram pops up on Tumblr. So I probably wouldn't respond to you if you spoke to me on Tumblr. But by all means, anyone can chat to me on Instagram or Twitter or Facebook.
Okay. Well, thanks for joining us today. And everybody should check out Once and Future Queen issue number one that came out on March 1st. I really enjoyed it and thought it was a really good book and look forward to future issues.
Thanks, Brian. Appreciate it. Thanks for talking to me.
Okay, thank you. Have a good day.
Take care, matey.
Bye.
Remember